Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 17th, 2011. You think those social networking sites know a lot about you? They got nothing on the banks.
They get new information almost instantly. So if you swipe your card at the store, the credit card company knows within seconds where you are and what you're buying.
And guess what? They're telling merchants what to sell you. We're always encouraging you to talk to your kids about money, but high schoolers in Florida are going way beyond talking. They're running their own credit union.
I like the idea that the kids are having a real-life experience of handling their own money, making their own decisions, and realizing the consequences of it.
And we revisit a family we profiled 3 years ago as they were defaulting on two homes.
Now we're in the clear. I can't declare bankruptcy for 7 years, so financially I'm a really low risk. But the banks will not lend me money.
Yep, they want a new mortgage. All that and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Anyone who uses Google or Facebook at this point knows that privacy is an iffy thing. But all those companies can really do is make an educated guess about your interests and then advertise to you. You know who knows exactly what your purchasing interests are? Credit cards and banks. And they are realizing what a cash cow that just might be for them. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith joins us now with the details. Hey, Stacey.
Hi, Tess.
So how much do these guys really know about me? How does this work?
Well, credit cards and banks know a lot about us. They know what stores we shop at, how much we spend, where we buy things, when we buy things, and they get new information almost instantly. So if you swipe your card at the store, the credit card company knows within seconds where you are and what you're buying.
Then I guess the key question here is, what are they doing with that information? I always assumed that that was, you know, eyes only.
Well, they're selling that information, actually.
Oh,
yeah, I know. Banks and credit card companies are offering that information to merchants. The merchants use it to figure out who they want to target with ads. Credit card companies like Visa are doing this, and there are a whole bunch of startups that are cropping up that kind of work like matchmakers for banks and merchants. They have software that they give the banks to help them analyze the data they have on us, and they offer that information up to merchants.
And I thought there were privacy issues with Facebook.
Well, the privacy issues, they're very sensitive about that. So the banks don't actually ever release the data. The banks just get the software to analyze it. The merchants never see your data, neither do the matchmaker companies. But the banks will offer them, you know, this is customer X who shops at Sears a lot.
But then how does that work for you and for me? I mean, if they're not saying exactly who I am, how is it tailored to fit me?
Well, okay, it's sort of like Groupon, except tailored to you. So Tess, I happen to know that you're a big foodie.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say that you spend $100 a month at Williams-Sonoma.
No, I host a personal finance show. What are you talking about?
Well, Sur La Table, big Williams-Sonoma competitor, might go to your bank and say, listen, we want to know who is regularly spending $100 a month at Williams-Sonoma, and we want to offer them a 50% off coupon for anything in our store. And then you would get an offer from your bank. You would see that coupon either when you checked your bank statement online, or you might get an email from your bank, or even a text message.
Oh, my.
Visa recently teamed up with The Gap to create these kinds of offers. And here's Visa's global head of products, Jim McCarthy, explaining how it works.
We know when they're shopping at, say, like a Starbucks at 8 a.m., based on seeing that transaction and knowing that a consumer is within, you know, let's say a mile or two of a Gap store, we would actually push a message to your cell phone based on your location that would say, you know, Gap is willing to give you, let's say, 50% off a sweater if you come in within the next 2 hours.
The merchant only pays if and when someone uses the coupon, so they love it. The banks get a cut of that fee, and so they're very happy. And the idea is that customers would opt into the program and they'd be happy to get offers they might be able to use.
Well, I suppose the question here is, does this work? Are people going to opt into this?
Well, funny you should ask. I actually handed my bank data over to a company that does this.
What?
I did it for you, Tess.
All in the service of reporting, right?
I know. If they clean me out, I'm hoping I can come to you for a loan. The company's called Free Money. They were very careful and respectful of my data. It's rolling out its service this summer. It's teaming up with a couple of the biggest banks and a bunch of merchants. And I asked them to use their technology to go through my credit card purchases and make me some offers. And here is Mike Linton of Free Money.
So the first gift would be $15 at Foot Locker.
Woohoo! I know you're a runner, so I suppose that's appropriate.
This is true, but that is not all. There were a few more offers they made me.
So the next gift would be $20 at Lord & Taylor, followed by $5 at Quiznos, followed by $20 at Pottery Barn.
So you are hungry and then you're going to go shopping. That's what they've figured out about you.
Yes, I can buy running shoes and run to Quiznos.
Well, I guess it's the creep out factor versus getting a discount, and people can make their own decision about that. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
You know, it's one thing for a teenager to have a savings account. It is another to want to sign up their entire school for one. Several high school students in South Florida have made that their mission. Karen Burkett of station WLRN tells us about their entry into the bank business.
High school kids are running a new credit union on campus in Riviera Beach, Florida. There's even an ATM in the atrium now. Their school, Suncoast Community High, is a place with plenty of high achievers. Newsweek magazine places Suncoast as the 9th best high school in the country. For 2 months now, teenagers have filled out applications at a table in the corner of the school cafeteria. Aaron Goldstein is president of Suncoast High's Economics Club. He's 16. He showed me how things worked.
And then we'll have usually two people working here, and we have the different paperwork in the desk.
He's just a kid, sure. But he and 19 other teenagers passed the same test grown-ups have to get into the bank business. They finished complicated coursework on bank finance law. Now they're qualified to sign other kids up to become members of the credit union.
And in a couple of weeks, they'll get their debit card in the mail, and then they're set. They can start banking.
Students only need $5 to bank with the Gold Coast Federal Credit Union. Parents co-sign applications so the students can be approved. Remember, credit unions are nonprofits. They typically charge lower and fewer fees than banks. Tazeen Rashid is a teacher who brought both the credit union and personal finance education to the school.
I was just asking some of my students today, like they're going to college and they're seniors, like, you know, how much do you know about financial management? And one of my students said, I don't know anything. So it's just, it's something which is very dormant, you know, it's and it needs to be awakened.
In another 4 years, those same kids will graduate from college. Right now, the average college grad accumulates $24,000 in student loans. Harriet Johnson Brackey is a financial planner at the Enrichment Group in Miami.
I like the idea that the kids are having a real-life experience of handling their own money, making their own decisions, and realizing the consequences of it.
Real life means saving, spending, and withdrawing from the ATM. Carlton Bone is a freshman who trained for one of the volunteer credit union jobs. He's 15 years old. If you'd asked him before the training, he would have told you he was a saver.
No, to be honest, I wasn't. It's not easy saving money. It's definitely hard to be patient with yourself, to store the money, and to not take it out on a whim.
The school wants to teach students about smart personal finance. The credit union wants to teach personal finance, too. But it also wants students here at Suncoast to become lifelong credit union members. Rob Delaney is the CEO.
You know, sometimes I think we forget what period of time these kids have grown up, and they're becoming extremely responsible.
And that's the greater goal, developing the next generation of adults who know how to save. In Riviera Beach, Florida, I'm Karen Burkett for Marketplace Money.
By the way, the idea of school savings banks goes as far back as the 1880s in this country. We've got a history on our Making Money blog at marketplace.org. Okay, so who's going to a wedding this weekend? Yeah, probably half of you. 'Tis the season for matrimony, after all, and we hope all the brides and grooms-to-be out there have had the money talk. For those who haven't, Lisa Gerstner of Kiplinger's joins us. Her article, Yours, Mine, and Our Accounts, is in the June issue. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you.
So finances are a decidedly unromantic topic, but how do you start that conversation with your partner?
A good way to start that conversation is to just, you know, set aside some time to sit down and talk about money. And do it when you know that you'll both feel fairly relaxed, you know, maybe after dinner, after you had something to eat. And tell your partner, you know, money's a common cause of fights, even divorce in relationships. So it's really crucial to talk early and frequently about your finances.
How early are we talking about? I mean, is this a conversation that needs to come up before a proposal, after a proposal, a couple of days before the wedding?
Definitely, if there's a proposal, that's when you should start thinking about it. Maybe before that, if you know that you're serious about each other and you know that it's going to go in that direction. Or even if you're going to live together, you know, you have to figure out how you're going to handle these things and make sure you don't get into fights about it.
What if it's just something that you've really never addressed, ever? I mean, you haven't even bothered with figuring out who's going to pay for a date. You know, it just kind of happens. I mean, money is just not something that we talk about. We just hate talking about it, especially with someone that, you know, that you're dating.
You know, it very well could be an uncomfortable conversation. Maybe one of you has a really low credit score and the other one doesn't. Maybe one of you has a mountain of debt to pay off and the other one is really strict about paying off your card each month. And, you know, you can meet in the middle. It's possible even for people with very different personalities to meet.
Well, you mentioned the credit score. How do you protect yourself from a partner's bad credit score? What kind of implications are there for you if the other person in the relationship has a bad one?
Well, the first thing to know is that any credit that is all your own is only your own, and it won't affect your partner unless you put your name on their accounts and vice versa. The other thing that is important is that if you do sign up with a joint credit card or something like that, then yes, your score could be affected. So approach it very cautiously. Also, you know, if you want to get a mortgage together, if one person has a lower score, that will affect the interest rate. Your rate will be higher. So in some cases, it might actually be better for one person to apply, depending on the situation.
Let's get down to brass tacks of merging finances once you are married and the discussion that takes place about that. You know, we've explored pretty much every option on this program. You have the yours, mine, and ours, or you mm-hmm. have the joint, or you have some hybrid of them. What's your recommendation?
Well, it's really about the conversation you have. There's not a magic formula. It's really all about what you want to do and what works for best for you as a couple. And one way to do that is to stay completely separate. You know, if you're feeling really independent and you don't want your money to be together, or if it's for legal reasons, whatever it may be, and you've had a lot of conversations about it and feel good about that, maybe you can do it that way. For other couples, maybe they mix it up. One married couple I talked to actually uses a joint checking account and a joint credit card for shared expenses. And that includes the mortgage, the utility bills, dinners they may go out together for. And in their view, a fair way to split those joint expenses is to base it on their salaries. So, for example, if she makes 60% of the income, she pays 60% of the bills. And they think that works really well for them.
Lisa Gerstner is a reporter for Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is Liz Pulliam Weston, personal finance columnist for MSN. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Tess.
So I saw this article in U.S. News and World Report with someone who was talking about how we are all probably going to be on a perpetual job search from here on out, that the time has ended for the job that you're going to have for a lifetime. In the article, he gives some tips for being prepared for that. And one of them is that you need to be able to answer the question, what is your brand promise?
Okay.
My response to that, which I both tweeted and Facebooked about, was, wait a minute, I'm a brand? Really? I don't know. This whole idea of being a brand just bugs me.
Understandably.
But I want to talk to you about it because you're a brand.
I've been told
that. And I like
that. I'm going to be on a panel in a couple of weeks for the newspaper columnists about building your brand. And I still roll my eyes at the concept.
Even though you are one.
Exactly. It's like, oh, please. And here's the problem, I think. It's encapsulated by another conference I went to where a young, bright college student stood up and she's talking to the, you know, incredible Alan Sloan, another columnist, mm-hmm. you know, great renown.
A regular on Marketplace.
Yes. And she's asking him how she should build her brand. And this evil smile just starts crossing his face. And fortunately, her professor stood up and said, maybe you should worry about a job, you know, getting a job and doing the job well.
There you go.
Before you even think about building a brand.
Why is it important. You know, I see myself as a journalist, and I'm a journalist who works for Marketplace. Why do I need to be a brand?
Part of the problem is it's focusing on surface rather than content. And I think that's what really gets us, is that, you know, people that are so concerned about their reputation and how others perceive them are being distracted from doing the job well. So I think in my core, that if you do your job well and you remember to once in a while mention to your boss some of your successes and achievements that she might not have seen, you are going to build a brand. But really, to me, a lot of it is actually helping other people. It's focusing a lot less on yourself and what you can get out of a transaction and seeing how you can help others. And I think that builds goodwill around you and ultimately builds your brand a lot better than seeing how you can promote yourself.
Well, let's see if we have any brands on the phone, shall we? Will is with us from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Will.
Hi.
Can you tell us what your brand promise is?
That's a tough one. I like to think just being authentic is a good enough brand promise.
I like that.
Especially coming from Portland.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
So what do you do there?
Well, I actually work in branding.
We did not know that.
So I really appreciated the discussion you just had. Yeah.
What do you brand?
Well, I work for a nonprofit that helps homeowners retrofit their homes so they're more energy efficient.
So then you must not be calling with a housing question then, because we get a lot of those, but it sounds like you've got that area taken care of.
Well, here's my conundrum. I bought this old home, a 1907 home, 6 years ago, and all the character had been ripped out of it, and it wasn't very energy efficient. So I've just poured a lot of my savings into it, just about all of my savings. And, you know, I've not only tried to restore the character, but also I've added solar electric and solar thermal, and I've insulated, and I've really done just about everything to it.
What kind of money are we talking about here?
I've probably invested $125, maybe $150.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of renovation.
Yes.
It is. The thing is, you know, I've depleted just about all my savings, and I haven't done the kitchen yet.
Oh, jeez.
Right.
And which is like going to be probably another $100,000.
Well, hopefully not. My neighbor and a good friend of mine is a general contractor and carpenter who does magnificent work. And he is constantly busy. So I am wanting to jump at a chance to get on his schedule for this fall and actually do a pretty modest renovation. It's in like the $20,000 range.
Okay, so the question is where you're going to get that money.
Yes.
Ideas?
I received one of these balance transfer checks from a credit card that I never use. And it's really tempting to want to use this balance transfer check. Apparently, you can write the check to yourself.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 0% interest for until August 2012. And it's got a 3% fee. And, you know, it sounds like a great deal. And I know the credit cards are basically betting against you.
Right. Because if you don't pay it off by the time next August rolls around, then you're going to have to pay some outrageous fee and probably all the back interest, right?
Precisely.
So, you know, this certainly is a potential way to go, but do we want to be putting home improvement basically on a credit card?
Well, let me ask some questions, Will. What is your credit limit on this card?
My credit limit is about $14,000, and I'm wanting to take out $10,000.
Where's the rest of the money going to come from?
I have that saved.
So, oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes.
But Liz, I think what we're looking at here is the utilization part of this equation, which is that you would be using $10,000 of a $14,000 credit limit.
Mm-hmm.
Liz, you are the credit score expert. This is going to be a ding, isn't
it? It's going to be a ding, and it may be a considerable ding. The problem with having a high credit score is that anything you do that looks like you're getting in over your head has an outsized impact on your score. Now, let me ask, if you borrow the $10,000 this way, can you get it paid off within a year?
I'm very confident that I will pay it off within a year without any problems.
Okay, but you would be using the rest of your savings. Is that what I hear?
Yeah, that's true.
Boy, so you are looking at then having no savings at all?
I will have no cash savings.
Well,
yeah.
Liz, does that send up some red flags?
Oh, totally. Totally. I mean, I know that you feel this pressure to take advantage of this opportunity that you've got. I just would be very leery of being in a position where you have this debt that has to be paid off by a certain point, and you've used up your savings. so that if anything goes wrong, you're really in a bad position.
You know, if you lose your job. Bring that up.
Yeah, I know. We're not very fun, are we?
Oh, I know. But waiting a little bit and building up a little bit of a cushion might make a lot more sense. I understand that you want to get this done and you're really eager to do the project, but we can talk ourselves into things that really aren't good for us financially when just taking a breath, maybe building up a little bit more of a cushion makes more sense.
Yeah, good advice, of course.
We don't always give the answer that the caller wants.
Yeah.
But does that help you out?
It's a good answer. Yeah, completely. Okay. Really appreciate your advice.
Well, thanks so much for the call.
Take care.
All right, let's go next to Anna, and she is in Whitmore Lake, Michigan. Hi, Anna.
Hi. Thanks, Tess and Liz, for taking my call.
It is our pleasure. Is that near Ann Arbor?
Yeah, I actually work in Ann Arbor. Whitmore Lake is about 20 miles north of Ann Arbor.
So what do you do there in Ann Arbor?
Well, my day job is a research scientist, but the reason I'm calling is because I started a business last year. I do metalsmithing on the side. And
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I've been doing it for about 7 to 8 years, but I really only decided to make it a business last year. And
So wait a minute. Let's back up here.
Sure.
Metal smithing. So what are you making?
It's a little bit of a misnomer. I make jewelry, and I primarily use sterling silver and some other metals like copper and brass and things like that.
Where do you sell this stuff?
Online. I have an Etsy shop, and my store is Three Birds Jewelry. So I primarily sell online, but this year, as part of, you know, trying to get my business more out there, I started to participate in craft fairs and art fairs.
So how much time does this take? You said you already have a full-time job, right?
I do. It wouldn't be uncommon for me to work at least 12 hours in my studio during the week, but additionally, I blog. I have my own, like, .com, and then I'm a blog contributor for another blog, so I'm all over the place.
Sounds like you've certainly got a handle on perhaps how to make this a success for yourself, but let me guess, are you wanting to know if you could fully follow your passion?
Yeah, if I wanted to, you know, have this be my full-time job, my dream, to work for myself, you know, what financial steps would I take to do that in, you know, say 5 to 8 years, something like that?
Liz, any first steps for Anna as she's looking at possibly leaving a well-paying, perhaps, full-time job?
Paying enough,
yeah. Okay. I mean, this is risky, but a lot of people have done it.
Oh, absolutely.
Particularly over the last 3 years.
Okay. Let me ask about that job. Are you working for the university?
No, I work for a private company called Cayman Chemical.
Okay. And do they have a retirement plan for you, a pension?
I do have a 401k, and they do a 3% match.
Okay.
And then I do have good health benefits here, which is, you know, another thing that I would have to consider.
One of the first things I was going to say is go out and shop what it costs to have an individual policy.
Okay.
In general, broad brushstrokes, your benefits package is going to be, add 30 to 40%. 40% of your pay. That's basically what it's worth and what you're trying to replicate. When you have your own business, you got to think about putting aside half of every check that comes in to cover taxes, benefits, the help you're going to need, like an accountant, things like that. Just a good general rule of thumb.
Okay.
50% is what has to go. So basically, you have to be earning twice what you are now if you want sort of a comparable salary.
Wow, I didn't realize it would be so much.
Yeah. We are not the bearers of most excellent news for our listeners today.
Not today. And I'm not saying don't do it because, you know, there are so many benefits to working for yourself. I don't want to undersell it, but I do want to say, you know, build up this business. Make sure it's something that's going to work for the long term. Make sure you're getting the kind of revenue you want.
So, yeah, that sounds like, you know, basically what Liz is saying is you better double what you're doing now.
Yeah.
And go from there.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a bit of a reality check, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's probably good to hear it now, though.
And another thing to make sure you do is get a tax pro. A lot of small business owners try to do everything themselves.
You
cannot keep up with taxes 24/7. Go find yourself somebody good that can help you out.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, ladies.
Good luck, Anna.
All right.
Good luck.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And finally, we have Duncan, and he is right here in La La Land. Hi, Duncan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
I always have to ask anyone who calls from L.A., are you, you know, an actor? Are you a filmmaker? Are you a set designer?
I am an aspiring director, though.
You are?
Yeah.
How far along are you in your career?
Well, I've had a short that got accepted to a pretty good film festival called Slam Dance a couple years ago.
Oh, so yeah.
That was a good step in the right direction, and I work for a director right now.
So how are the finances, given that you're still trying to learn and get yourself established in a career?
Well, I actually have two jobs, because my job for the director is 3 days a week, and then I work another 3 days a week at a restaurant. So the cash flow, well, it's maybe not as much as I would like. You know, it's paying all my bills right now, and I'm actually able to save money, which is great.
Good. Well, that's wonderful. Well, so how can we help you out then?
The issue is that it hasn't always been this way.
Oh.
And about 2 years ago, I had a really, really hard time finding work for about a year and a half. And during that time, I took out two credit cards, and we're talking about for very low levels. One was for $500, one was for $1,000. But I lost my job. I couldn't find another one. I went through all unemployment, and as a result, I basically just went completely delinquent on these two credit accounts.
So let me guess, it's not just $1,500 anymore.
It's $3,900.
Ooh, that's just painful. You go.
I know.
You more
know.
Than doubled your debt.
I know.
Are they coming after you at this point?
I basically avoided phone calls for like 7 months, and then at that point, they stopped calling me, so it was easier to forget about it, and then they started calling my parents and my brother and anybody I've ever lived.
Ah, there you go.
So at this point, I'm kind of wondering if I should pay off this debt in full or whether I should try to negotiate with them, and also if I do want to negotiate, is it worth going to like a debt consolidation service or somebody that will negotiate on my behalf, or is it worth just trying to do it myself?
Okay, so then assuming that we are going to go ahead and take care of this somehow, we've got $3,900, basically $4,000 worth of debt.
Mm-hmm.
A collection agency is banging down the door, not just his, but his parents.
Yes.
What's the best way to take care of this? And you've actually counseled people to not pay it.
Well, in some circumstances, it really doesn't make sense. But in this circumstance, it may. And one of the things you have to worry about is the fact that they collection agencies more often are suing now. And sometimes you don't get adequate notice that they've sued you. Then it's a judgment. Then they can garnish your wages. Then all kinds of, you know, chaos can result. I do think people should pay their debts when they can. But as you've mentioned, there's sort of a lot of fluff built into that $3,900. There's
right.
outrageous interest. There's fees. There's all kinds of stuff. So if it were me facing the situation, I would look at starting with an offer of about a third of the debt and see where you go from there. Now, if you can save up $1,300 in a couple of months or $1,500 and make them a lump sum offer, you're going to have a much better bargaining position than if you have to make payments.
Okay.
And the other thing you want to do is make sure you get their assurance in advance and in writing before any money changes hands that this debt will be taken off your credit report and that the unpaid debt won't be sold. I don't advise hiring somebody to help you with this. The amount isn't big enough, for one thing. There's so much fraud out there and so many scams.
Yeah, debt collection is just, that's a phrase that you want to run from, unless it's a nonprofit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And the nonprofits are going to try to get you to pay it off in full. Oftentimes, they can't help with collection accounts. They're dealing with the original creditors kind of a situation. I mean, it depends. But in this case, given the amount involved and given your resources, I would say you can do it on your own.
Okay.
Does that help you out?
Yeah, I think I feel fairly positive about the situation.
Well, good. I'm glad we could have a good answer for
yes.
at least one of our callers today and not make them sad. Thanks for the call, Duncan.
Hey, thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can send us an email at the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz, I think you fulfilled your brand promise today. Much appreciated. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tess.
And do remember to check with your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. Actually, you know what? Let's follow up on this whole brand promise thing. If you think you have a brand promise, we would like to hear about it. If you need help figuring out what your brand promise is, send us a note either on the website or post on our Facebook page or tweet me at Radio Tess. We're going to bring in an expert who presumably will disabuse me of my loathing of the term and can help out one lucky listener. Maybe even earn somebody a piggy, too.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets. because of your giant wallet. Just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Johnny Lindsay, and I was wrongly convicted, and I spent 26 years in prison. And once I was released, my life could not begin until I had a proper ID. It felt like I didn't exist for a moment. With the help of a social worker, she took me to all the necessary places to get my birth certificate and high school diploma. But then I was able to go to the Texas Department of Public Safety, and they issued me my ID. Once I got my ID, I could go open up a bank account, and it was like, you know, I'm alive again. Yes, I have a daughter that was born right after I was locked up. She lives in New York, and I had to have ID to even purchase a plane ticket, and I didn't have an ID to do so. So that was very frustrating, and I was determined, you know, to get to New York. So I finally got my ID and was able to purchase a plane ticket. For 26 years, that's the first time I had seen her. And it was a reunion that no words can describe.
We met the Sinclair family of Patterson, California, 3 years ago, just as the housing crisis was coming to a head. Patterson is a subdivision just off Interstate 5 south of Stockton. The family had stopped paying their mortgage and were essentially squatting in their own home. They bought it in 2005 for $440,000. When we visited in April 2008, it was worth less than half that. They wrote to us recently with an update, so we went back to Patterson for a visit.
Welcome back.
Dan, how are you?
Hi, nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Come in, come in. Watch out for the train tracks.
Oh, my goodness.
A kid's train set took up most of the living room floor. Dan Sinclair is a 46-year-old systems analyst. He and his wife Esmeralda and their three kids now live in a rented home just a few blocks away from their old house.
Last time I was with you, we took a walk around the neighborhood, and it was astonishing to see how many foreclosure notices there were on doors, dead lawns. This doesn't look too bad.
It's getting better. Next door, the house was empty for over a year. And it just got occupied by renters.
It's a mix now of renters and people who have owned the house. On the left, we've got some renters, and they're always cranking the loud, you know, rap music. Not that there's anything wrong with rap music, but because I don't
know. So more renters in the neighborhood now than there used
to
be.
Yeah, well,
definitely.
Including us.
Including you. That's
but
right.
We're nice renters.
When we profiled the Sinclairs 3 years ago, they knew they would not get another 3,600-square-foot home with a four-car garage and a pool anytime soon. One lesson they learned was that a big house wasn't worth a big mortgage. The one they're now renting is 1,000 square feet smaller. But they are still dealing with the financial aftershocks of the last one.
Looking back, I don't think the bank ever really intended to work with us at all. They wanted to push it to foreclosure, and they did. And they sold it for less than what we wanted to renegotiate for.
You know, at least Dan still has a job, which has...
So that's been the saving grace, is that I've kept my job through this whole thing. I have, I'm pretty well compensated, and I was still able to do a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and that's what we had to do to get rid of our debt.
Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Why such a desperate measure? Because they owed almost $200,000 on their home after taking out equity loans, and they owed $500,000 on a second rental property that they were trying to sell. In the end, they lost both homes.
You know, there's something else strange that has happened as part of this process is now we're in the clear. I can't declare bankruptcy for 7 years, so financially I'm a really low risk. But the banks will not lend me money.
But wait a minute. Are you telling me that you think you should be able to get another mortgage?
I do.
3 years after basically losing
the
two homes?
Well,
how does that make you low risk?
Well, I guess it depends if you look at the pattern of... Was there reasons for that? I mean, how many people are out there? 20% of the residents in this area are like that. You know, this house that we rent, we pay $1,400 a month. I could own this house if I bought it and pay less in mortgage than what I'm paying in rent, which is kind of a heartbreaker for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I consider myself a really good opportunity for someone to loan money to. Not history aside, because I don't think the history...
But you can't set history aside.
But it doesn't indicate the level of risk here. I can't declare bankruptcy for another 7 years. They should be banging down my door because they're going to make their interest money back regardless or put me in debtor's prison. I mean, there's nothing I could do if I try to default in the next 7 years. I'm not the bad guy. I mean, whatever.
But wait a minute. Look at this from the point of view of people across the country who are going to hear this and say...
That's true.
Wait a minute. You were part of a serious problem. I mean, yes, banks certainly had a large role in it, but so did homeowners who got themselves into homes that they couldn't afford.
Yes, I think we made risky decisions. I'm really surprised by your surprise. How much do I have to pay for my sins, if you will? You know, we went through incredible stress.
What has this done to your credit scores?
They were, well, while we were going through it, they were down to 550. As soon as I closed my bankruptcy, it went up to 630. So, you know, that wouldn't get us a very great loan, but we're back in loan territory except for the bankruptcy and the history.
Yeah, except for that.
Yeah, it's so funny. Your surprise is so funny to me. It's a kind of a wake-up call from where we see things. When I talk to our friends and stuff, nobody looks at us as part of the problem. We all kind of look at ourselves not as victims, but as not guilty in this whole process. And maybe that's not realistic or self-preservation, but, you know, when I talk to people at work, either they're holding their tongues or they don't say, well, it was partly your fault, you know, because I guess we've all done it out here.
And surely that sentiment is not exclusive to the Sinclairs. It's a frustration millions of homeowners nationwide are grappling with. You can hear our original visit with the Sinclairs from 3 years ago at marketplace.org. Chances are you've experienced at least one of the following at work. Your boss took credit for one of your ideas, a coworker blamed you for something, or maybe you even took credit for something you didn't deserve. In his new book, The Blame Game, psychologist Ben Datner says credit and blame at the office is no different from what you'll find at the zoo.
People are hardwired by evolution, human evolution, and we're actually not the only primates to blame others and to deny blame. In the book, I talk about Coco the gorilla, who one night was playing with a toy cat and broke it, and the next morning signaled that her nighttime attendant had been to blame for breaking the toy cat.
Well, let's get really practical about this for our listeners. Is there a right way to place the blame, you know, in an acceptable and professional way?
Well, blame is really about the past, what either did or didn't happen. And it's looking for individuals who are to blame. And the thing about blame is it's very personal. It's very much about people and their personalities and their character. What I think enlightened organizations do is they take a broader view and they think, what is it about our systems? What is it about our culture? What is it about our collective approach to ascertaining what did or didn't happen and what went wrong or didn't go wrong? What is it about that that's either working for us or isn't working for us?
What if someone blames you for something that is not actually your fault? How do you protect yourself without seeming awfully defensive?
Well, there's a lot of subjectivity in blame. So sometimes we blame other people unfairly, and sometimes we may perceive that we're being blamed when in fact we're not being blamed. One of the things I talk about in the book is about how the millennial generation, which the Wall Street Journal called the most praised generation, expects a lot of praise in the workplace. And
yeah,
for them,
these are the kids who got trophies whether they won or lost, you know, at team sports, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Everyone gets the gold star.
Yeah.
So for a millennial, they may perceive that they're being blamed simply because they feel insufficiently credited. So one person's blame might be another person's feedback.
Well, you know, you say that we have a choice in how we respond to credit and blame issues, and that actually some people are just better equipped to deal with that. What do they have that the rest of us perhaps can learn from?
Well, it's always easier and always more fun to talk about the negative cases. I'll answer your question about the positive cases in a moment. In the April 2011 issue of Harvard Business Review, Robert Hogan and I wrote an article entitled, Can You Handle Failure?, where we talked about the types of people who are dysfunctional with respect to credit and blame. And unfortunately, about 70% of the American population falls into one or more of these categories. Extra punitive, where you blame other people unfairly and harshly. Impunitive, where you either deny blame or deny your own role in what went wrong. And finally, intrapunitive, where you blame yourself too much and too harshly. So what great leaders do, as Jim Collins wrote in Good to Great, is they look out the window and in the mirror. They look in the mirror when things go wrong and take personal responsibility and blame themselves, and they look out the window to credit other people. And that both simultaneously helps the leader learn, grow, and adapt him or herself, and also makes other people feel credited, valued, and loyal. So Ursula Burns, for example, the CEO of Xerox, has talked about how sharing credit has helped her get to the top, sharing credit for ideas that even she may have had. But she told the New York Times that she was advised early in her career by Paul Allaire to give other people credit, thereby expanding the pie. What bad leaders do, and I can mention Teflon Tony Hayward from BP, is they deny blame or they blame other people, and they actually diminish the social capital in their organizations.
That must be an awfully hard point to get to there, where you are looking in the mirror for blame and looking out the window for credit. Because if it's innate to monkeys to blame everybody else, then it probably is for us too, right?
It is too. But I think what great leaders do is they learn that it's more important to be strategic and to operate in their self-interest rather than to just be self-serving.
All right. I'm going to start trying to look more in the mirror for blame and out the window for credit. Ben Dattner is a workplace consultant and an adjunct professor of psychology at New York University. His new book is The Blame Game: How the Hidden Rules of Credit and Blame Determine Our Success or Failure. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Gotta blame it on something. Gotta blame it on something.
Before we leave the realm of psychology, one more peek into our brains on money. We saw a headline on health.com the other day, 10 careers with high rates of depression. It was based on a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services survey about drug use. They asked nearly 100,000 people whether they'd had a major depressive episode in the past year, and then they were categorized by job. Among those in the top 10, folks who work in the financial industry. We asked Marketplace's Sean Cole to look into it for us.
I talked with the reporter who wrote the article, Tammy Wirth. She said there are a few specific ingredients that might make a job more likely to trigger depression. Long, unpredictable hours, for example, and lack of control over the consequences of your actions. In this case, how financial markets perform.
Particularly when there is high demand and low control. Those were some of the things they said typically or maybe more apt to have someone have a depressive episode.
But Tammy's not a therapist. And neither am I. Nor have I ever managed millions of dollars of other people's money. So I found a therapist.
My name is Patrick Labella. I'm a psychoanalyst in private practice.
And a money manager.
My name is Maureen Whale, and I'm a certified financial planner professional.
And introduced them to each other.
Hi, Maureen. I'm Patrick. How are you?
Hi, nice to meet you.
The idea was to have a kind of Oprah-ish discussion and see if we could divine A, whether financial work can indeed contribute to depression, and B, if so, how. Come to find, both Patrick and Maureen were the perfect candidates for this exercise. Maureen's been in the financial world for decades, and Patrick has a bunch of financial workers on his client roster.
Let's see, two hedge fund managers, an accountant, and five or six financial advisors.
He says sometimes you can chart their mood by what the market does.
And if it's doing horribly, like in 2009, it's a devastated bunch who come in. But I'm not so sure that I would call them depressed. I would call them maybe sort of traumatically impulsive emotionally.
Maureen says her mood doesn't really fluctuate with the Dow. She tends to be pretty conservative with her clients' money. Now and then, though, she worries that some of the middle-aged ones won't have enough to retire on.
That gets me a little anxious. I wouldn't say necessarily depressed, but I know depression. So, you know, over the years, I've figured out how to kind of get myself out of those types of things. So.
And how do you mean you know depression?
Well, I actually did work in the corporate world in a finance type job, accounting type stuff. And I'd say in my 30s, I guess had what you might call a major depressive episode. That's when I said to myself, I better go talk to somebody.
This was after 2 years of suffering clear symptoms of depression. for instance, a tight perpetual knot in her stomach. Maureen didn't speak up sooner for a couple of reasons. One, she says, she's first-generation Irish-American and you just don't talk about such things. Two, she's in finance, for heaven's sake.
Financial people, certainly, I don't think they'd necessarily be comfortable admitting that, you know, they're not always feeling at the top of their game.
It is an absolute weakness to have to say to your friends, oh, I'm headed to my therapist. I've got to leave work early tonight. And these are a bunch of guys sitting around trading desks saying, excuse me, where the heck are you going?
Right.
Therapy? What? We're going to the bar. Let's go, man. It's very much frowned upon.
Case in point, Patrick has a client, a broker, who gets ribbed by other guys on the floor for going to therapy. In private, though, two of those guys have asked him for Patrick's phone number, but they haven't called yet.
You need to be able to ask for help when you need it.
Right. I would say I was definitely, and probably still am to some extent, that type of person, unwilling to ask for help.
Unwilling to?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are you? And you're working on that?
Yes.
I think it's wonderful that Maureen said that, because just being able to say that tells me that she is working on it.
So that major depressive episode that you're talking about, would you say that that was directly related to your work?
I would say that the work didn't help, but I think it's probably part of who I am, no matter what type of work I did.
Turns out Maureen's family has a history of depression. Over the years, she's learned that various aunts, uncles, cousins, all of them seem to have struggled with it.
And this is what I wanted to get to, because I feel like we're talking about really a kind of chicken and egg situation, where it's like, is it the job or is it the person? And if it's the job, is it that the job attracts that kind of person? Do you know what I mean?
I'm so happy you asked that question, because I was looking at this study and I was thinking to myself, I would much prefer to read a study that says, what jobs do depressed people seek out? There's a characterological level of depression that we're all born with. And we pretty much, you know, try to improve it throughout our lives, but it's always there.
And that's where we landed. Of course, this is just one discussion with one therapist and one money manager. Maureen's doing a lot better, by the way. Her therapist suggested medication, which is working well. She still gets that tight feeling in her stomach sometimes, but only at appropriate times, she says. Like when she was on the way over to meet Patrick and me. In New York, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Killeen, Texas, and listener Trey Moody. He heard our Memorial Weekend interview about financial readiness for members of the military, and he wrote us to say that it's not just young service members who need help with financial education. It's also non-commissioned officers and other leaders who soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines may turn to if they're in money trouble. Mr. Moody is doing his part to help in that effort. He volunteers with ACS, Army Community Service, teaching budgeting and finance classes to service members. For that, we bestow upon him the Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Yeah, it may not be a bronze star, but it comes with our thanks and praise for his bravery in talking about money, because nobody really wants to do that. And his audience has sophisticated weaponry. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, restaurants are getting creative when it comes to getting you to spend more money, like not even telling you what your entree will cost.
I feel like when you're in a group of people, especially friends, and you stop to say, oh, wait a second, how much is that? It's akin to pulling out your wallet and counting how many dollars are in there.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week. This is APM, American Public Media.